Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're looking at something pretty fundamental, the laws of physics. But not just for physicists.
Right. We're thinking about how these constants of the universe, these sort of deep truths about how things work, can actually be used as mental models.
Yeah, practical tools to help you make better decisions, maybe in your career, relationships. I mean, just navigating everyday life.
Exactly. It's about finding shortcuts, really. Using this timeless knowledge about the physical world and applying it in places you might not expect, it helps cut through the noise.
So today we'll explore a few key ideas from physics, like how to stop fighting against the current all the time.
And why what you put out there tends to come back to you, that whole reciprocity thing.
And also, why is it so darn hard to start something new?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe even harder to stop something old? Inertia.
Let's dive in.
Okay, first up, this feeling we sometimes get, you know, that we're pushing a boulder uphill, constantly fighting the system.
Yeah, it's exhausting.
How can physics help us shift that? How do we work with the world instead of always against it?
Well, there's a fantastic historical example for this one. It involves Arctic exploration back in the late 1800s.
Okay.
So ships trying to reach the North Pole kept getting, well, destroyed, crushed.
By the ice.
Exactly. The Arctic sea ice expands, it shifts, it exerts this immense, unbelievable pressure. The standard ship hulls just couldn't take it. They were designed to fight the waves, maybe, but not that.
So they were trying to build stronger and stronger ships, I guess.
Pretty much. But this Norwegian scientist, Fridtjof Nansen, he had a different idea for his ship, the Fram. He thought, what if we don't fight it?
Right, if you can't beat the pressure.
But you work with it.
Yeah.
He looked at the reality, this unavoidable ice expansion, and let that dictate the design.
So what did he do?
He designed the Fram with this really smooth, rounded hull, almost like a shallow bowl or maybe a cylinder cut lengthwise, and almost no keel sticking down.
Okay, smooth and round. Why?
Because when the ice started squeezing from the sides and below, instead of crushing this rounded shape,
It would pop it upwards.
Precisely. The force pushed the ship up, so it ended up resting on top of the ice pack, safe and sound.
That's brilliant. It used the destructive force for its own safety.
Totally. And it worked. The Fram drifted across the Arctic Ocean, stuck in the ice but not crushed by it, for 3 years. Got incredible data, proved the Arctic was an ocean. A huge success.
So the mental model here is, don't just build a stronger wall against reality.
Yeah, or maybe understand the forces at play so well that you can design something that lets reality, lets that inevitable pressure actually lift you up or carry you along. Work with the grain.
That makes sense for something like ice pressure, maybe slow and predictable.
Right.
But life throws curveballs, right? Things feel chaotic, random sometimes.
That's a really good point.
How do you know when to design that clever, curvy hull versus when you actually do need to push back hard?
Right. It's not about being passive. It's about first acknowledging the scale and nature of the force you're up against. Is this something you can realistically overpower? Or is it a system-level force, like that ice? And once you accept you're part of a bigger system, you immediately run into the next big idea from physics, relativity. Because your view of that system is, well, limited.
Right. Like the classic thought experiment, the scientist on a smoothly moving ship.
Exactly. If they drop a ball from their perspective inside the cabin,
it just falls straight down. Gravity.
Right. They don't perceive the ship's forward motion carrying the ball horizontally at the same time. For that, you need someone standing still, maybe on the dock, watching the ship go by. They see the whole picture, the vertical and the horizontal movement.
So we're all kind of on our own moving ships.
Yeah.
Our perspective isn't the whole story.
Never is. Relativity at its core tells us our viewpoint is unique. It's relative to our own motion and position. We don't automatically see things from other perspectives.
And not realizing that, not accounting for that limited frame.
Yeah.
That can have serious consequences. Where does this really bite us?
Well, one of the most high-stakes areas is eyewitness testimony, especially in, say, criminal trials.
Oh, definitely.
Think about the case of Min Du Kong in Washington State back in 2000, a really tragic, complex situation involving a confrontation and a killing.
And the sources said there were, what, a dozen eyewitnesses?
Yeah, about that. But the problem was their stories were all over the place. Wildly conflicting accounts of the same event.
And it wasn't just memory playing tricks.
It was more fundamental. Some witnesses described seeing things they literally couldn't have seen, just based on where they were standing. Physics wouldn't allow it, their line of sight was blocked, or they were too far away.
Wow.
Plus, you had other distorting factors. Things like bias, maybe knowing the local victim versus the accused, who was an outsider. There were issues of racial bias mentioned, drinking, fear, all twisting perception.
So the jury essentially had to become like physicists, trying to figure out whose testimony even aligned with physical possibility, let alone accounting for bias.
Pretty much. They had to piece together a plausible reality from these fractured, limited perspectives. In the end, they deadlocked, leaning heavily towards acquittal, suggesting they believe Hong might have acted in self-defense after, you know, facing a hate crime.
The takeaway, then, is stark. Our own view is never complete.
Never. We have to actively work to see other perspectives. Use thought experiments like Galileo imagining a fish's view, or just talk to people with different viewpoints. It's like how our brain takes the slightly different images from each eye and creates depth perception. You need multiple inputs for a fuller picture of reality.
Okay, moving on. Let's talk about feedback loops. That feeling that what goes around comes around. Newton's third law, right? Reciprocity.
That's the one. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
And physically, this isn't just a nice idea. It's ironclad.
Absolutely non-negotiable. Anytime you exert a force on something, push a wall, throw a ball, that object exerts an equal force back on you in the opposite direction. It's always a two-way street. You act on the world acts back on you.
There's a great illustration of this in sports, I think. American football.
Yeah, the tackle. It perfectly shows what we could call the principle of least force.
How so?
Well, think about the tackler hitting the receiver. The force the tackler puts onto the receiver
is the exact same force they feel themselves?
Exactly the same, just in the opposite direction. So if you tackle someone incredibly hard, you're also hitting yourself incredibly hard.
Huh. So there's actually a built-in incentive for the tackler not to use excessive force.
Right. Your own self-preservation dictates using only the minimum force needed to bring the receiver down. Anything more just means more potential damage to yourself. It's immediate physical reciprocity.
That makes sense for avoiding negative force. But what about positive actions? If I put a huge amount of positive energy or effort out into the world, does reciprocity guarantee an equally positive reaction comes back to me?
Now we're getting into the complexities of applying physical laws to human systems. It's not always a direct, tangible tit for tat. Consider the life of Dr. Norman Bethune.
The Canadian surgeon.
That's him. An amazing figure. He pioneered mobile blood transfusions during the Spanish Civil War, then went to China and set up crucial hospitals, trained doctors, just poured his life into it.
He definitely put massive positive force out there. Voluntarily, right? No obvious personal gain.
None. It was driven by his beliefs, his values. But look at the reaction. He died young, only 49. From septicemia he contracted directly because of his surgical work in harsh conditions.
So in a way, the immediate reaction was devastatingly negative for him personally.
Physically, yes. The system, the demands of his work, absolutely exerted an equal and opposite force that ultimately cost him his life. But there's another layer.
Okay.
While his communist beliefs led to him being largely ignored, even erased in Canadian history during the Cold War in China, he's revered, a national hero. His story is required reading in schools.
So the positive reaction, the legacy, it came back just differently, delayed and in a different place.
Exactly. Reciprocity guarantees a reaction, but maybe not the one you expect or when you expect it. For Bethune, perhaps the most immediate return wasn't fame or fortune, but the internal reward, the deep satisfaction of living completely aligned with his convictions. The effort yielded meaning, even if it also cost him his life.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly. Why is change so hard? Starting a good habit, stopping a bad one. It feels like pushing that boulder again.
That brings us to inertia, Newton's first law.
An object at rest stays at rest. An object in motion stays in motion.
Yeah.
Unless acted upon by a force.
Right. Objects and systems resist changes in their state. It's easier to just keep doing what you're doing, even if it's not great staying in that job you dislike. Maintaining that habit you know is bad.
Because changing requires effort. It requires applying force.
Precisely. To overcome inertia, you have to expend energy. Staying the same, that takes almost nothing. It's the path of least resistance, less uncertainty. You could even say just maintaining any structure, any order, is a constant fight against entropy. The universe's tendency toward disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But changing structure, that's extra effort.
We see this inertia play out on a huge scale too, right? Like with harmful substances. Why did some get banned relatively quickly while others stuck around for ages, even when we knew they were dangerous.
That's a great contrast. Think about absinthe versus lead.
Absinthe, the green drink.
Yeah, the alcoholic apéritif. It got banned pretty fast in places like Switzerland and France, maybe within 50 years of its peak popularity. There's a lot of moral panic stories linking it to violence, absinthe murders, they called them. Mm-hmm. Later science showed it wasn't really worse than other strong alcohol, but the perception was enough.
So it was relatively easy to stop its momentum.
Comparatively, yes. Now contrast that with lead. We've known lead is toxic for, what, millennia? Clear evidence for centuries. Yet lead in gasoline and paint. It wasn't banned in the U.S. until the 1980s.
That's a staggering difference. Why?
Inertia is related to mass. Lead had enormous societal mass. It wasn't just a drink. It was deeply integrated into major industries.
Cars, houses, infrastructure.
Exactly. It served useful functions, even if harmful ones. Removing it meant huge costs, finding replacements, retooling factories, dealing with existing lead paint and pipes. The force needed to overcome that massive integrated inertia was immense. Absinthe was, relatively speaking, lightweight and standalone. Easier to apply the force needed to stop it.
The inertia of a system is proportional to how deeply embedded, how massive it is. That makes sense. And this connects to velocity, doesn't it? Force equals mass x velocity.
It does. Speed alone isn't enough. It needs direction. And mass affects how much force is needed to achieve or change that velocity. It underlines the old saying, better to go the right direction slowly than the wrong direction with speed.
Is there a historical example for this one, too?
Napoleon's invasion of Russia in 1812 is a classic, if grim, example. He banked everything on velocity speed towards Moscow. He saw his army's strength as its mass multiplied by its speed.
But the sheer size of his army, its mass,
became its downfall. Maintaining speed over that enormous distance, nearly 2,500 kilometers, with such a massive force, required sacrificing logistics, supplies, adaptability.
So the mass actually hampered the velocity he needed.
Critically. When conditions got tough, the weather turned, supply lines broke down, they lacked the resources to adapt or sustain themselves. The immense mass required a level of support they couldn't maintain at speed. He lost something like 2/3 of his army before even reaching Moscow, mostly to disease, starvation, attrition.
He prioritized speed over sustainability, and the mass made it impossible.
Exactly. Moving fast in the wrong way or without the resources to support your mass and adapt is often worse than moving slowly and deliberately in the right direction.
Wow. Okay, so let's recap the toolkit we've built here from physics.
We started with the Fram working with reality, letting pressure lift you instead of crushing you, designing around inevitable forces.
And then relativity, reminding us our perspective is always limited. We need to actively seek out other views to get closer to objective reality, like dealing with those conflicting eyewitness accounts.
Then reciprocity, Newton's third law applied to life. Actions have reactions. What you put out comes back, which often means using the least force necessary is in your own best interest.
Though maybe not always in the way you expect, like Dr. Bethune's story showed, the return might be internal meaning, not just external reward.
Right. And finally, inertia and velocity. Understanding why change is hard systems resist change and bigger systems resist more. And that speed needs direction and sustainable support, especially for massive undertakings like Napoleon learned the hard way.
It feels like all of this, the effort to work with reality, the energy to seek perspective, the force of our actions, the struggle against inertia, it all leans towards a really big concept in physics.
The thermodynamic.
Yeah. Specifically, the second law, entropy. The idea that in any closed system, disorder or entropy always increases over time.
It's the universe's default setting, moving towards equilibrium, towards, well, blandness, randomness. Creating and maintaining order, any kind of structure, requires a constant input of energy. Without that effort, things fall apart.
So when you look at human civilization, all our efforts, our laws, our social structures, our stories, our goals, mm-hmm. are we just constantly pushing back against entropy?
In a very real sense, yes. We expend enormous energy just to build and maintain order, to create systems and meaning in a universe that naturally tends towards chaos. These structures we build, careers, families, societies, habits, they are all temporary islands of order we actively maintain.
That's quite a thought. We're fundamentally entropy fighters.
Constantly putting in energy to nudge things away from randomness, towards some kind of intended structure.
So, to leave you with something to think about, given that maintaining any order requires this constant energy, take a look at your own life. What existing structure, maybe it's a complex relationship, a demanding job, a long-held belief, even just a daily routine is currently demanding the most energy from you just to keep it going, just to fight its natural tendency to change or dissolve. what might happen if you decided to stop expending quite so much energy on that particular structure? What shifts if you let a little entropy back in?